Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success. Gas mark 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm gonna cook a meal that's gonna make you mine. I'm turning up the oven, now we're ready to roast. When you touch me, honey, you'll love me the most. Come on and put me in your loving shoes.
Welcome to another BritFish.com podcast. My name is Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Vaughan Savelle. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Stuart.
And thank you for soldiering on. Having got the great Lurgy of our times prior to us.
Yeah, well, I think I have. I don't know that I have. Okay. I think okay. It's probably likely. I haven't seen anyone for a long time. Had a premiere on Thursday. It's not surprising that having hugged and kissed everyone for 2 hours, I've managed to get it. There you go.
Right. Finally. Well, that's a good segue for me. The premiere was for your two-part documentary, Gaza, which by the time this goes live will have aired on BBC. And be available on iPlayer for everyone to watch at their leisure. Do you want to start by just telling us how did the premiere go? What was it like to finally see your film with people?
It's good. I mean, it's an interesting one because it's simultaneously a two-hour for the BBC, and it's also cut as a 2-hour feature, which will be released on DVD in May.
Fantastic
and so
news.
We were seeing it on the big screen, and seeing it on a screen that size in the Ham Yard Hotel, which we hosted with Kaleidoscope Distribution, was incredible. And it's a wholly archive film. There's no talking or anything like that. So of course we take in the archive and work on it for years as offline archive. So it's like the lowest version of the archive you can see. And then obviously in post, as we bring in the real online archive, it gets better and better and better. And the grade from brilliant grade from Molinaire makes it better. But then the whole other level is the music by Blank Mass, the sound mix, that footage of some of those iconic footballing moments and weirdness of life in the 90s.
Yeah.
British life in the 90s on a screen that size was quite remarkable. Sadly, Paul didn't make it to the screening, but all his family were there. It was very sort of moving experience all in all, really. It was a big success. I'm very, very happy.
Well, look, congratulations. And I think for our UK listeners, Gaza is a ubiquitous word to mean Paul Gascoigne. But I guess for our overseas listeners that might have tuned in for this podcast, Gaza won't be such a readable, recognisable word to or of the same meaning. So do you want to just give a brief synopsis to what Gaza is as a documentary?
Sure. And it's quite interesting in terms of making, you know, I know your podcast is about filmmakers and filmmaking. And it's quite interesting reason that it's called Gaza. so Gaza is the ubiquitous nickname of Paul Gascoigne, who was a footballer from Newcastle, from a place called Dunstan, Newcastle, who basically took the footballing world by storm and became probably one of the most famous people, not just most famous footballers, but one of the most famous people in the UK throughout all of the 90s to the extent that today you only have to say Gaza and pretty much everyone in the street of a certain age will definitely know who he is. He was at that time the highest paid, and most people would recognize that for a certain period he was the greatest footballer in the world. So his name obviously is Paul Gascoigne, but the film is about that period, the decade of that sort of super fame and the height of his career, where Gaza, you couldn't turn on the radio, you couldn't look at a newspaper, this is pre-internet, but you couldn't look at any form of media without seeing the word Gaza, and Gaza mania was a thing. And yeah, he was just probably next to Princess Diana. He was the biggest name in the UK. And we wanted to make this film. It was a brilliant idea from the director, Sam Collins, who came to us with it, to make this film that was not Paul Gascoigne. It was about that period. It was about the media's and all of our experience of his life at that time. But telling the truth about what was lying behind that, you know, because it was a time that became synonymous with phone hacking and the tabloid press just going too far in their hunt for stories, which has been very well documented and has been through the courts and everything ever since.
So you always were intending to tell that twin track story, because it's a very powerful one, which is, I mean, I'm a 50-year-old man and Paul's 54, so you know, it's kind of, you kind of looked at him as like as your peer, but out with absolute envy at the same time. When he was coming through, and you know, 1990s, it was, he cries at the beginning of 1990, and there an icon is cemented forever and a day. I mean, me and my friends used the Gary Lineker "Have a Word," I think, throughout half of the 90s as an express when anything was going on, no matter how silly or serious, you would tap your eye and go "Have a Word," and that was directly from that moment in the World Cup 1990. So. Just to give anyone a flavour as to how, you know, for a certain generation, because I don't know what it feels like as you go down the years, like, but he was important. And so your film really conveys the bit that I'd forgotten, I guess, with the celebrity explosion that then overshadows it when you get the second half of the 90s, is that he was the world's best footballer.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a wonderful clip of a friendly where he's playing against Maradona, and you see really how wonderful he is. He just sort of goes through them like butter. It's he was an amazing footballer. I mean, the other footballers describe him that way. You see footage of him from his earliest appearances at Newcastle. But as you know, we say with the film, it's not the Paul Gascoigne story. It's really the Gaza story. It's about how that explosion took its toll on him. And the key thing there, and it's what yes, to answer your question, it always was the vision of the film. And Sam came to us with that vision. And I watched, he'd been working on it for a couple of years with Keith Haviland and Mark Stewart. And it had sort of reached a hiatus. They didn't know what to do with it. And so we watched this very, very, very long cut, rough cut of what it sort of could be. I remember watching it thinking it was just like watching a big true crime film. It was like a series. Oh. And I kept having to, as I was watching it, I kept having to remind myself that Paul is alive. I'm not about to see that this is not the murder of Paul Gascoigne, It felt like this sort of, this really exciting period true crime of British life, because there was just so much darkness in the way that the press operated. And why Paul is particularly good for the focus of that is coincidence, the happenstance of the universe, that the great sort of media owners like Rupert Murdoch, but not solely, were sort of looking for a power grab. And power was the people, the man on the street. There was no internet, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook. And so it was about tabloid newspapers and football. And so money went into football. The press was sort of grabbing trying to grab as many readers as they could in the millions, not like today. Their circulations have gone down hugely, obviously. And at that time, just by coincidence, the best footballer on the planet was also this incredible character. And so for the first time, arguably since George Best, but nothing had been for George Best like this was, for the first time, you had this guy who was on the back page and the front page. Mm. And everything in his life was scrutinized. And obviously, that's where certain members of the tabloid press went too far to get those stories. But the key thing, of course, is we all read them. You know, we're all guilty of being part of that. Just we didn't know what it was. And we didn't, you know, the takeout is we didn't think about the toll it might be taking on him and those people, on people like Paul. So yeah, it's a cautionary tale in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think you know, I'm a lot more media literate than I was back then, and the idea that, you know, and look, we still have it to this day. Oh, they're paid enough money. Why should we care about them? Kind of thing. It's the
yeah,
price.
100%.
It's the price you pay. And we did it for Hugh Grant, and we did it for you know, Steve Coogan. You know, it was the same. You know, the same tabloid hacking stories revolved around the same kind of knee-jerk response. Which obviously, when I think back to it, is fueled by the same papers that are doing it, that are giving you that narrative that, you know, they put themselves up to be there.
100%. But do you think, Stuart, I don't know what you think, but because you can't say it, what I'm about to say is not true to a certain extent, but you do look at them and you think you can tell from what he's done with his life and how he lives and how he has been the figurehead of the anti-phone hacking movement, that Hugh Grant is a guy who can handle it. Mm. It may have upset him hugely. It may have ruined his life at times, but he's a guy who can handle it. And I think the key thing is you look at these films, I look at these stories, and you look at, let's forget Paul Gascoigne for a minute, who, you know, the film is about the fact that it wasn't easy for him to handle. He should have found some help somewhere from someone. Is that you look at, what, November, the World Cup comes along again. Let's hope not, but some 19, 20-year-old kid is going to miss a penalty.
Yeah.
And who's there? What's being done for them? How, you know, the hate they'll get from idiots.
Yeah, well, we've had the dry run, haven't we, I suppose? I mean, in a weird way, as a complete comparison, given when your film's coming out after the Euros, actually, probably the kiddest of kid gloves has been the treatment of the England team during the Euros of 2021. You know, I've never seen anything like it where it was a loving, and the hate fest didn't follow. There was no one to blame.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like, aren't these guys good? And, you know, you could argue that's probably down to Southgate as someone who was vilified.
100%. And you'd hope that that is the model for the support, for the, you know, the closeting of people who are, not because you're right, where I simultaneously do have the feeling of you get paid an awful lot of money to kick a football. You know, you don't have to. You can walk away. Mm. But they are kids. You know, I'm a dad. I've got an 18-year-old. I've got two boys, but my eldest is 18. He could be on that pitch, you know, and I know he might, to the outside world then, he's a man playing football. To me, they're still kids.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Jude Bellingham's on the rise now, isn't he? And already he's been talked about like he's been doing this all his life, which, yes, he has. But all his life, he only amounts to 18 years, of which six months of it as officially as an adult. I love the way that then the focus of what we're watching is that kind of rise and fall of him through the archive, as opposed to a bunch of contemporaneous sort of talking heads. I mean, there are talking heads, but we don't see them because they talk over the footage, which I think is a really a clever artistic move. So how much of that was always the plan, and how much of that came about because that was the best way to tell the story?
Well, it was always the plan.
Okay.
And Sam Collins always wanted to do it that way. There's a bookend shot that we have, which is contemporary, you know, today of what Paul looks like, of him, you know, how he started, where he's got to. But yeah, it was always the plan. And it's because that footage is so evocative to see that time, to see somebody like Linda Lusardi, who was incredibly famous at the time. She'd been a Page Three girl and model, and she happened to become a friend of Paul's, and the, you know, purely platonic friendship. But just her voice in particular for me is such trustworthy. But to see her as she was then, hearing her now talk about that time, is basically in a way the essence of the film. Mm. So I don't think we'd have, there'd been certainly, it's hard to imagine the benefit of seeing her now, saying those things when you can, she's describing, she says in her own words, I think, believe it or not, at the time, this is at the start, very start of Paul's career, I was more famous than he was, which is why they became friends, because nobody wanted it. And of course, you could film her saying that, it would kind of mean nothing. She's a very, very beautiful lady of the age she is now. But actually hearing her say it, just an example, I'm giving you this, while seeing her, you know, being mobbed by the press and stuff like that, and, you know, having her photo taken. Yeah, no, that's true. So it's just a very simple device in many ways. It's just often, we're doing a new one soon where we will have talking heads. And it's just because that archive doesn't exist for the things they're saying. It's, you know, it's you'd have to be much more abstract. So in this case, it was just, as Sam has said many times, you know, it's how there are so many bits of footage of Paul Gascoigne that how do you fit them in? There's over 1,000 clips in the film.
So. Is there really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I guess the sort of thing that I take away most from the film is you took me almost physically, certainly mentally, back to a time that I remember well. But it also felt like I'd gone to a foreign country at the same time.
Do you think, Stuart, for me, it's like trying to describe this in the time we were, it's been 5 years in the making. We were on it for 3.5. And, you know, trying to describe to my sons what it was like at the time. And the thing that you cannot convey is that pretty much at the end of where the film ends historically, most of the film anyway, is where the internet starts.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is you go back, it's right, the past is a foreign country. And you go back and you go, God, it's, you know, you and I are old buggers now, but we go, it feels like yesterday, but there was no internet. It's crazy.
But also I think that's testament to us being of a generation that were allowed to be young, even when we were adults, as it were, which goes back to your point about saying that Gaza was also young, but was being treated like he was the prime minister in some senses, but being expected to be like a kid when they turned the camera on him. You know, it was like he could never be himself because it was never right and it was never wrong. It was always just a story. And I think your Hugh Grant comparison before, I was thinking that I think Hugh, arguably, and he can't say this for himself, but arguably Hugh knew there was a Faustian deal going on. And I don't think he was inviting the editor of The Sun to his wedding, whereas I think that made it that your film, that's the bits that I didn't really appreciate as the backstory to what I was consuming in the media, is that actually his missus, him, were talking to the tabloid press as if they were friends without appreciating ever that that was just feeding them lines, which feels like a really big portrayal at the heart of the film.
Yeah, totally. I think so, and I. But you know, you also have to say that all of those people, not just the people in our film, all those people who were involved in that were adults who knew, were capable of knowing they were doing it, which is why people like Hugh Grant probably didn't. You know, and I just think the big difference. I keep sort of crapping on about the internet, but I do think it is a weird difference in that. There's almost a way you could describe or look at it as once you're in it because you're famous for something you want to do, there's only one way to control the narrative, the public narrative, which they had control of because they would write about it, was to engage with it to a certain extent or not at all. And so you have the question, therefore, of any given moment, is this opportunity or is it exploitation? And that's the thing where the balance is such a fine line. You know, it's so, because no doubt Paul made an awful lot of money out of the fame he had. And that was partly by being in the tabloids all the time. But what is, when was he being exploited and when was he taking an opportunity is the question. The difference now is, of course, that the readership is smaller because Twitter exists, for example. So Marcus Rashford, obviously a very, all players are public focus, but because of other things he's done off the pitch, he's very sort of public footballer, if you like, through your degree. If a newspaper says something about him on a Monday morning, maximum like 700,000 people read it, but he can go on Twitter seconds later and say, this isn't true, and talk directly to the millions of people who follow him. And so it must be, however difficult that is still, it must be a very different feeling to know that the control of your narrative is completely, that the access to your audience is completely in your hands. Now, does that mean they'll handle that well? No, of course not.
I'm just imagining now Gaza live streaming on a Sunday evening after the, you know, the papers have, you know, eviscerated him or something. I can see how that would work. But I don't just think of the other part of the story where the close relationship with the tabloid is one thing, but also his unique lawyer and accountant arrangement. I think if you're gonna hang a hat on anybody to do with exploitation, you could hang it on them more because they've got the distance and the stake in Paul to say we need to take Paul out of the limelight. We need to, you know, because they had the power and the influence potentially. I don't know that for sure, obviously, but looking at what I can see in the film and understanding they're the ones getting him to sign the contracts for everything, and they say, you know, he didn't do all the public events and all that kind of stuff. You kind of go, where were you when he was having such a close relationship? But you get the sense of their learning was also his learning, but they were grown adults, professional, you know, lawyers and accountants. So they kind of had a peer group where they could turn around and go, this has gone wild. What do we do now? And, you know, so whereas Paul didn't have that. And then, you know, the big story within, I guess, Paul's down after his big rise is the biography that gets written about him by someone who worked for him. And you're like, there's no wonder he couldn't think straight after that, I don't think.
Yeah, I think, I mean, his accountant and lawyer at the time, who were sort of de facto managers, I don't know if they ever do, I can't remember, they do sort of call themselves managers, but they definitely had genuine affection for him. They definitely tried to do the best for him in many ways. I've never personally, and this is only my personal opinion, I've never had a clear sense of what culpability they have in what Paul was like and what he did and what happened to his money and all of that stuff.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
But I absolutely do see and believe from them that no one had managed this situation before.
I mean, I'm not attacking them for it. It's more.
It's sort of fascinating. It's kind of the observation.
They had the ability to stand back, whereas he didn't. And I think that it felt like them getting swept along was as interesting to the story as Paul being just the center of what's been swept along.
I think another way of sort of putting what you mean is that if you've got two guys who are so bright and so professional and they can't cope, who can?
Yeah,
who could
yeah.
have? These days, people expect it a bit more. They've seen that car crash sort of happen, and they do more about it.
But it's not long. But if you think about a tabloid story not long after of the same decade of that dominated the decade in the same ubiquity, you've got Oasis by 93. Who are going toe to toe with the tabloids. And you're right, that they probably do show that kind of yin and yang of exploitation. This is good for my career. Exploitation is good for my career. Flip flop. And you can see there's an exchange of value between the two, and they understand what's going on. I'm not saying they understand literally, but they understand there's something that they have to do something to get something. And they're always, you know, but they didn't get driven out of, you know, being a songwriter, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I think the difference, I can't really put my finger on why, Stuart, to be honest, but like the difference there was their sort of public anger. It was part of their being. It was part of their sort of stock in trade.
But they were in 10 Downing Street, weren't they, by 97? You know, it's like
exactly.
that kind of icon of the 90s.
Yeah.
It's sort of, it's really interesting that
how
people, I mean, but you know, but I guess the big difference is that then when, you know, I don't get too much into the details to spoil it for someone watching it for the first time, but you get into the personal relationship problems of Paul Gascoigne in the documentary. And at that point, you're that cheek by jowl with, you know, pictures of men, a man in with plastic breasts, you know, we're all laughing. Then they have to then, you know, the point of that exploitation is that then they're going to have to write about what you've been doing. What you're doing with your life.
Absolutely.
Becomes
the good and the bad.
Becomes a story you can't say, well, hold on a minute. I know we all had a laugh for 5 years, but you can't now point the finger at me for 5 years. But that's unfortunately what seems to have happened, for better or for worse. And you can see that. There's that scene on the lawn when he's in his kind of suburb. I mean, it's weird to see a footballer of his level in just a suburban estate. You know, now it's gate. You know, I live in late in East London. If I go out to Chigwell, it's like gated communities where football, you won't get anywhere near a footballer's house.
No. It's crazy, especially because he wasn't an averagely paid footballer.
No, he was like,
he was at the top and he still lives in fairly average cars and houses. Yeah.
And his argument is that of a real, of a young, as a, you know, have you played football? You know, it's like as if he's on the school railings. It's not, there's not an adult talking there, really.
No, exactly.
You kind of go, you ain't going to win that.
Petulant. And,
What did you discover about Paul Gascoigne through the making of this film that you didn't appreciate going into making the film?
The big answer is sort of, and the truest answer is sort of boring in that it is immersive, this film, and you do get your head around you. Anyone who has any empathy is there thinking, what would it be like? This film often reminded me of the Truman Show in that, you know, he was so under scrutiny all the time, partly by his own doing. And so it was to, exactly as you said, to go, wow, I remember all of this. And I had no idea that his life was like this. I think the thing I didn't realize, to be honest, is that he's what a bright bloke he is. There are some very sort of candid moments on camera where he's asked questions and his wit is just incredible. You know, you'd look back and you remember the football and you remember him being kind of crazy, but he's actually, you just see the intelligence of him. I didn't realize that he is so brilliant at other sports. Like he can pretty much play anything.
Oh, right.
He can play tennis and he beat somebody really good at tennis. I can't remember who it was. I have to ask Sam, but he can play. He's got all kinds of trophies for other sports. He's just a sort of a freak, you know, in that way. So yeah, that would be the takeout, that it was the potential of him mentally and in other sports that most people wouldn't know about.
For a Jude Bellingham to watch this documentary, it is a true sort of warning from history about what not to do, as it were. And I don't mean all the personal details and stuff. I just mean in terms of your relationship with your sport and the media that covers it, in many senses.
I think the big thing there, of course, is that whatever the psychological help and support and financial support and everything that clubs make sure these boys do have, the other thing they majorly do, which is a big difference in the time, is that if you were using alcohol as much as many of those players were at the time, the clubs would know. You don't get away with it today. These footballers just don't.
Your internet watershed becomes almost like a booze watershed. If you look at like the careers of, say, James Milner, who doesn't drink, you know, he was having his first game of football at the time Gazza's career's ending, and he's never drunk. And it's such a comparison.
And, you know, as we say in the film, we do sort of point out, but it's very well documented, you know, there's other top players of that England team drank as much, if not more than Paul did during that time. Mm. And so you're talking about a group of young, very young men with a lot of money and, sadly, a lot of time on their hands because they only train like once a week, once a day, and then have the rest of the day free. It's well known as well, I think, that the concurrent with that as an issue that has persisted because they can test them for alcohol and, you know, they can tell in their performance, their fitness data, but gambling is the other problem. It's harder to test for that. And so it's just, it's a thing to monitor. But yeah, as you say, cautionary tale for all these young players.
Because you know, you get the voice of Paul Merson, and Paul Merson is just basically saying, well, it's not as bad. It's almost like I can get away with what I'm doing because I'm not as extreme as Gazza is, and I can almost be under the radar here. As if that was a good thing. I mean, I remember at the time, you know, because Brian Robson, when he was at his height, you know, he liked to drink a two in the 80s. He went from Rangers to Middlesbrough to essentially a drinking club in want of a better expression. Yeah. I remember that being a thing at the time anyway, you know, just thinking that.
And it's you know, very basically the evolution of sports science, isn't it? In that a lot of those guys would openly just have a little drink before going on the pitch.
When Gazza says he has a brand new, you hear that now,
and it sounds insane.
But then, have you seen the documentary "Believe in Miracles," the Nottingham Forest one, where Brian Clough basically was like, "Where's John Robinson? Oh, he's having a cigarette. He's having his pre-match cigarette." You're like, no, you know, the difference now in the way the sport is.
I'm old enough to remember. I'm a big rugby fan as well. I remember the French rugby team smoking at halftime.
It is like this comes back to that point that the 90s is like a foreign country in the way that we might have thought about stuff. Yeah. And it was almost like, in a way, it's like, you know, and Paul's cautionary tale is almost like tracking that kind of decadence and complacency of how you can live fast and there's no consequences, but actually there are. You know, the 80s was full of people washing up on the shores of having made all these wrong decisions, but then suddenly the football money got ridiculous. I mean, Paul obviously went to Italy for the first wave of the big money, then not long after the Premier League kicks in and then football money starts to mushroom and it becomes... Because the 1990s, I mean, you know, going back as a memory of football, you know, I was into football before 1990 and it felt, you did feel, I mean, this is something I feel very strongly, you know, it felt like football was taking off you at that point from the football fan.
At the point with the Premiership.
Well, even though that's the conclusion to that taking off you, but Gazza crying, football becoming popular with people that don't like football.
I see.
Lad Mags come around, then the Premier League starts, and suddenly you're like, we've always been into football. What are you talking about?
And suddenly
it's like it's interesting for, you know, for want of a better expression, you kind of get a middle class interest in football.
100%. Yeah,
which
I get
then
that.
You know, if I project even further, you know, then that becomes, you can see that becomes the moral arbiter of how Paul Gascoigne shouldn't behave, because in a way he's behaving like all footballers have done time immemorial in a way.
Yeah,
just that the stakes were higher because the money was higher and the publicity machine. I mean, I wasn't aware of that Maxwell Murdoch sort of fight for the readership. I mean, that's interesting as an instigator, and it's just in you know. Put Paul Gascoigne's peak 5 years earlier, and he doesn't get half the trouble he's got.
Yeah,
you could argue. I mean, look, that's hypothetical.
Yeah, I mean, this is without ruining the film. One of my favourite bits of the film is almost an end coda where his sister, obviously extremely close to him, knows him best. Sort of as a loving family member, poses that question: what would have happened if Paul had been an average player? And it's the same as what you're asking, really, is what if none of this other stuff had happened and football had stayed football? What would he have been like? He'd have, you know, he might have moved clubs, but he would have just been a guy who grew up as a Newcastle fan, played for Newcastle, was a hero at St James's Park. But, you know, there's been millions of those
absolutely.
Who go back to, you know, have a run a business or, you know.
Going back to the process of making it, in terms of,
yeah.
So you deliver a brilliant story, like I say, of a rise and fall of Paul Gascoigne, and like with the closing image, essentially, it's a rise. For me, it's a rise, you know, he's still here, for Christ's sake.
That's, he's a survivor, yeah.
That's
he's
an amazing thing to survive, yeah. You know. And there's, you know, the goal he scores in the 96 Euros is just one of the greatest goals you'll ever see. I mean, it's just, yeah. the backdrop to it. And I remember being in arguments in the pub, and we were talking about, you know, what's wrong with the dentist check? You know, the tabloid press, where you were against the tabloid press at that point. So when he does the goal and does the celebration, it was an amazing moment. So that was, and obviously that's the central story, your where Gaza goes, because that's the name of the film. But also what you deliver on in story terms is a few story arcs in terms of some of the voices we hear from the tabloid press and what they represent. And you close off. How did you manage that element to it? Because in a way, that wouldn't have seen the most important part of it, but obviously the tabloid versus Gaza is you can't tell one without the other. And you actually give us a real kind of other warning from history, which is, let's not be this vindictive again and this intrusive. I mean, I think MI5 is used as a kind of descriptor of what they would do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it is a look, we all love, we're all obsessed by fame. We are relentlessly obsessed with finding out more and more about famous people and celebrities and seeing their dirty laundry, as it were. And that was the start of that, sort of taking that power to be able to do that too far into the realms of, you know, going through people's dustbins, et cetera, et cetera. So they would literally use private investigators to follow people to get more stories. And so what we did do was show how certain members of the press sort of had their careers made by these stories. They rose to the top of their profession, having had success in so doing. Piers Morgan, obviously, being one who, it's crazy to see now, during the making of this, I'm not sure if he's done it recently, but during the making of this, Gaza went on Piers Morgan's show again. And if you see this film, you'd sort of think, God, there must be sort of deep animosity, but it does show the intertwining of the relationship between the hunter and the hunted in this case, of those stories. So it was always a challenge to weave the two stories. I made a film about Joe Calzaghe, and that they have these challenges that are you're making an entertainment in itself. You know, it's got these things tend to have a three-act structure. And so your stories, like telling a joke or telling any fairy tale or whatever, like, you know, back to cavemen's days and Greek theatre, etc., your stories have a shape of their own.
Absolutely.
But when you start making a documentary, sometimes the person's life doesn't fit the natural storytelling. And those are the challenges. And you're right that weaving those two the two storylines of Paul's life, you know, his football life, his personal life, and the tabloid exploitation of his life or covering of his life were the things to weave through. And of course, them having moments that coincide with each other is often where the magic of story comes from, because they did. Yeah. And other times it's sort of less easy to sort of make it a good viewing experience. When I'm making the Calzaghe film, the difficulty was that it's like a train track. He fights, he trains, he fights, he trains.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he fought loads of people. He fought many more people at the beginning of his career where nobody really cared. He wasn't making much money, et cetera, et cetera. And his big four fights came in the last couple of years of his fighting career. And so that, if you can imagine, I'm just saying that doesn't lend itself to a good three-act structure.
Yeah,
it's
sort
of warped. And so the challenge is finding a style of story and all these things that you're sticking to. And in the Calzaghe's case, it was adding a genre to a documentary. So for me, it was thinking, oh my God, this is a heist movie. This is the gang is set up Joe and his dad, who was, you know, crazy, crazy guy, really amazing guy, but had never boxed and never coached boxing. And this kid who was a bit small, had been bullied at school, but was just a prodigy. They came together as they were father and son, but they became fighter and trainer. In putting together a heist gang, they're the most unlikely guys in the world. And they go into the bank, which is the world of boxing, which is dirty and, you know, full of money and whatever. And can they get out of it with the money? And, you know, if you watch the movie, they do.
So that's an amazing metaphor. Do you have a metaphoric way of looking at the Gaza story then? Because, I mean, I must admit, as a viewer, I'm watching it going, please, please, because I felt like it was a Gaza story that became almost like a hacking story on the side. And I was so hoping, as a viewer, that you were going to draw those threads tight at the end, which you do brilliantly. And I think it's a testament to the film that I felt satisfied in that sense.
It's not as dramatic a metaphor because there were so many elements in this one, and the archive nature, it was different, but it was very much that true crime feeling. I would think all the time in being in the edit with Sam and Will Kane and the editors, like, we're still making the Who Killed Gaza, which is not Who Killed Paul Gascoigne.
Yeah.
We're making Who Killed Gaza. Gaza was a dream, like Rome. Yeah.
He's Truman.
Gaza
He's
was
Truman
a legend.
In your Truman.
Exactly. Show. Who made him? Yeah. What was he? And who killed him? Because, again, it's very hard to do this without giving too many spoilers, obviously, but Gaza was a guy who lived to play for England.
I think that's a good way to sum it. Yeah, I don't think you need to spoil it any more than that. I think that's a perfect way of setting the scene, really, because I think that's where, because you can't make him do that, and all those emotions you see on screen that you kind of have forgotten about, and then you're reintroduced to them, you go, if nothing else, Paul Gascoigne cared, like nobody, like few others have. I mean, lots of footballers care about the moment, the game, and then they go off the field and they shower and they go home and they're going, what's for tea? I don't think Gaza ever did that in his life.
No, and he to this day, I spoke to him recently, and I was saying to him, I said something about, I can't remember how it started. I said something about, well, do you, I said, what, do you miss that much? He said something about missing football. I said, what, do you miss that much? And he got extremely emotional. He couldn't express to me quite how much he still thinks he could play. And he says, I know I can't. He says, but I want it so much. I can't bear it. I said, that's right. I said to him, do you watch football? He said, no, I can't bear it. I said, what do you mean? He said, I want to be out there. I can't. I don't watch it anymore. I can't. It upsets him so too sad. Much that he's not playing. So sad. It's so sad. but there you go. So yeah, it's the true crime. The Who Killed Gaza. Thank goodness Paul Gascoigne to this day survived it as a man. But yeah.
Well, look, it's a brilliant documentary. And I thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed the nostalgia you, I mean, because it's interesting, like I say, as a person who lived through it as an audience member first time round, I mean, being the Mars bar joke, and I hadn't realised how much I knew it, and then Satan Greavesy coming up, and I'm like, this is a foreign country. This is like, I lived through this, I do remember it.
Yeah.
And absolutely joyous, and, you know, very... Yeah. Ultimately, very tragic, and that's kind of weird. But like you say, when you compare it to a true crime sort of story, the character of Gaza is the thing that came and went. Obviously, thankfully, Paul Gascoigne is still here to tell the tale, as it were. So let's remind people then, it's going to be aired. It'll be aired on television by the time they see this. So it's going to be available on iPlayer, but it's going to be out on DVD when?
I'm not exactly sure the date, I'm afraid. It's mid-May. I think it's something like the 14th of May, but it's mid-May, yeah.
Okay, well, look, it just gives me to say thank you very much for indulging this old man with his youth.
It's like looking in a mirror.
No, honestly, yeah. I mean, just that I was crap at football, so the mirror isn't that accurate. But yeah, thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you, Stuart. Cheers. Let you love me, take a thousand.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.